How do you get your research published in high-impact journals?
Do good research. And I think younger scientists tend to overstate the importance of the journal. I think there are a lot of reasons to publish a paper, only one of which is to have your name in JAX or, you know, whatever, Science or Nature. I have however many papers, and I don't have a paper in Science or Nature, but I did get tenure and full professor in relatively short order. So, you know, how big a deal could it possibly be? But the most important, I think things to do when you're publishing: one, you want to make sure that the kernel of knowledge you put in the paper is good. It's going to survive. It's going to not be something that will be usurped by, the next 0.1% of efficiency or whatever, you know, field you happen to be in. That what you're doing is contributing knowledge, not just numbers, to the field. And also that once you have this paper out, even if it's in Sensors and Actuators Q, you can then refer to it in a talk. And if you're in a talk that has 30 people in it, you know, that paper that you're talking about is just as valuable on the screen as it is if it was published in JAX. Or if you're writing about it in a grant proposal or a fellowship application, the fact that it's peer reviewed and it is this corpuscle of true stuff, we hope true, of true stuff, that you can refer to it and it takes on a longevity and a seriousness that it doesn't have if it's not published.
Grad students and postdocs are busy. How do you vet undergraduate researchers so that they are productive and not breaking equipment?
Excellent question. It takes a long time and a lot of concerted effort to recruit anybody, whether that's an undergraduate or a graduate student or a postdoc or an assistant professor for that matter, although I think most issues of breaking equipment are not that important for assistant professors. We like to shake the tree for a long time before we make the commitment to hire somebody. And by hire, I mean even just take on an undergraduate volunteer. So they will come to a few group meetings. They often will interview with multiple people in the lab to find the right project student fit. We have cases where the student has been in the lab in a class for a really long time, and like for the whole quarter or the whole semester. And you get a better idea of like what kind of conscientiousness they're going to have. But you know, mistakes still happen and they could start in the lab and they could be a disaster. So typically at the beginning, an undergraduate volunteer is on a probation system where they are not really a full member of the lab until the second term that they're in the lab. But that's a good question. Overall, I'm very happy that we've had the amount of undergraduate involvement that we have had.
I know that you have an MBA in your resume. How valuable do you think business training is in academia?
I'm a big fan of business training in college education and in academia. I think a lot of us as scientists and engineers tend to think that it's all BS and that it's all soft, fluffy stuff. But the fact is, you can have a technological solution to a huge societal problem, a technological solution that would work tomorrow, a good example being solar energy, yet it's policy that is the reason that it's not being done. It's policy, it's politics, it's competing competing interests, and without the right business incentives, without the right tax structures, without the right investments, without the right skills and talking to the right people and saying the right words in the right order, none of that stuff is going to get done. And that's what business and management and entrepreneurship training does. To the specific, I think, implied point of like starting businesses, I think that can play an important role in academic research groups, not the least of which is that it gives a student something to do after they graduate, especially if it's their work that was that's being commercialized. It could be a source of unrestricted funding for the lab. If you look at labs that have been very successful in converting their intellectual property into royalties, but that is actually quite rare. Only really the top X percent of labs have been successful this way. But also, you know, if you're a faculty member and a student starts a company and you have an equity stake in the company as either a co-founder or a scientific advisor, you should probably be scientific advisor unless you're planning on giving up a lot of your time to be a co-founder. You could have an equity stake in the company, and if it has a liquidity event like an IPO or an acquisition, you can, you know, put that money back into the lab, right? Or buy yourself a solid gold car. but those are some of the ways that they might interplay.
Can you describe ways in which criticism from your students has landed particularly heavy and changed your approach to teaching and mentoring?
Mentees and students can be rather unforgiving in their criticism. The classic thing is the student evaluations at the end of courses, and you can see 99 excellent teaching comments, and then there's that one that really stings. And if it stings because it's just mean, then you know you're upset for a few hours and then you forget about it. But if it stings because it's true, then those are the ones that stay with you for a long time. One time I got the comment that they might have even used the word engaging or charismatic or something during lecture, but that I did not provide a welcoming feeling when I answered questions after class or in office hours. And I was actually quite deeply hurt by that comment. And I think it was true. And it wasn't just true because I kind of felt that I sort of lost energy after the lecture and maybe in office hours I wasn't giving it my all. But it was also because that was the second time I had heard that comment. And the first time I heard it was from our postdoc advisor, Chenan Bao, who said after one of my talks that your energy level goes off a cliff. I shouldn't just use those words, but after you gave that seminar and you answered questions very dry and like you were being defensive or annoyed to be asked a question. So I've thought about that very deliberately since getting that criticism. In the context of research, I recently went through a promotion process. So in the University of California system, we have these steps within each level, and I was going from professor whatever to professor whatever, you know, N plus whatever, N plus X. And one of my mentees wrote in the anonymous comments that that the one-on-one meetings with this particular student weren't that useful because I was too I was too big picture and didn't help them enough with their day-to-day experimental design and how to solve particular problems. And in some cases, it's because I haven't really worked in the lab in more than 10 years, and I don't know exactly what, I don't know how to work the machine that they're using. But in many cases, I really could do a better job at internalizing the day-to-day, struggles in the lab. And I've really taken that to heart and tried to improve along that axis.
What is a Venn diagram, and how has your Venn diagram showing the overlap of teaching, research, and service changed over time?
So the Venn diagram is the circles that overlap. They have gone through many iterations. I think giving this talk was especially fun for me because I didn't actually make a Venn diagram until a few days ago when I made the slides. But I had thought about it for a long time. I think that there had always, I had tended to view my career trajectory in a more linear way. So I did this because I did this. And it hasn't been until fairly recently, especially with the associate dean role, that I've started to see my work in context and how it fits together. But I thought that if I had thought about this much earlier, I think I'd be better off than I am now. It might have seemed a little bit abstract, but it would at least have been a hypothesis that I could have tested. Like I would have said no to a lot more things earlier on so that I could have focused on, okay, this is how I'm going to arrange my research, service, and teaching activities. Good question. I wish I had a more satisfying. Oh, thank you, Changua. Appreciate that.
Is funding between researchers distributed equitably? And what would you do to change the way science is funded?
How much time do we have, as they say? I'm joking a little bit, but there is a lot I would change about the funding environment. To answer the first question in a yes or no manner, no, funding is absolutely not distributed equitably. The top researchers who get the Science and Nature papers get, more and more funding. I think that their research proposals, when they come in, get a famous person premium. They get a prefactor attached to them. And it's a lot like how much easier it was for me to get a paper into NanoLet or Advanced Materials when I was a member of the Whitesides group or the Bao group than it has been as an independent investigator. And I'm not, okay, you can take that as a complaint if you want, but it works the same way for grant review. It is unquestionably easier to get stuff in as an established investigator. If I were a program manager of NSF or NIH, I would put a lot more of my portfolio's budget into funding individual students. The first thing that would do is that it would spread the funding around more to away from the larger groups that might have reduced capacity because they would no longer have as much money for like materials, supplies, and recharge, so that smaller labs that where the mentors can be more actively engaged would have a greater share of students. The other thing that it would do is that it would reward investigators for being good mentors. So right now, there is no mechanism whatsoever in the NIH to determine, is this PI going to grind their students to dust, or are they going to support them fully after they graduate? And if you empower students and postdocs more than the system tends to do now, they will gravitate toward the labs that provide good mentoring, that provide excellent service after the sale, and so forth. Another thing it would do is it would allow students to work on the problem of developing their own ability to select important projects, because they could work with their PIs to craft proposals that actually, you know, meant something, because there would be some money that would come in as a result of them. And I'm not saying the whole portfolio, but of a program manager to be devoted to training, to be allocated to students and postdocs, but much more than tends to be done with the NSF GRFP, the NIHF 32, and so on.